Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohlig right here on LA Talk Radio.
Oh, and are you ever? And on such a beautiful day here in Los Angeles.
It's a beautiful day in the hood.
And it's especially beautiful to me because you're back.
I'm back.
Mr. Paul Strohlig
is back.
I'm back
and I'm bigger than ever. Yes.
Yes. I'm after back. What was that, about a two-month vacation?
It was actually 6 years.
6 years?
Six weeks. I was in New York and Chicago and locales in between and got to see family and then family and family. And
how is your mother, by the way?
Charlotte's fine. She was so excited to see me. We're so glad when you're here at the holidays. Because, you know, it's more like... It's more like Christmas.
Yeah. No, Charlotte's doing well.
Dear Charlotte.
And she, you know, she only sounds a little bit like that. I don't know why I've totally Brenda Vaccaro'd her over the time.
Nor does she.
Yes. Just like, you know, I make her like an ad for an expectorant.
Oh, my goodness. Well, before we get into all that, why don't we thank our sponsors who are
such
lovely people at the beginning of this new year. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talented agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com.
And we'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We are grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to our live arts calendar.
Yay!
Yes. Yes.
Yay. So...
Sorry, this
voice?
Guy wandered in.
Small little voice. Kind of came right out of Into the Wood. And then, Pane de Zakopane.
Zakopane.
Pane, excuse me. I know we just went over this.
And yes. Some of us did.
Yeah.
Some of us were paying attention.
I missed that lesson.
Read the flashcards, Michael. Just read the flashcards.
I'm starting over, man.
Train to Zakopane, a true story of hate and love. A new play by Henry Jaglom reveals humanity in the most unlikely of places. Prejudice. This original new play, which opened in a world premiere on November 27th, I believe. No, 27th, yes, at the Edgemar Center for the Arts, is based upon true events that occurred in the life of Henry Jaglom's father as he crossed Poland on a train in 1928. Anti-Semitism was, at that time, rife in much of Europe, especially in Poland.
In Train to Zakopane, a true story of hate and love, a successful Russian businessman meets a captivating young nurse in the Polish army on a train trip to Warsaw, and he is faced with a life-changing dilemma when he discovers that the nurse he is drawn to and who is enchanted by him is fiercely anti-Semitic. Will he reveal to her he is Jewish? Will he move toward love, or will he move toward revenge? We are joined by two cast members who play the leading roles in this critically acclaimed production. Please welcome Tanner Frederick and Mike Falco.
Welcome to State of the Arts, guys.
Thanks for having me back.
Yes. Yeah,
I just can't help but I'm just laughing back here trying not to snort while you guys are doing the intro.
Is snorting a problem?
You're funny guys. Yeah.
That's always a sign that I've successfully made... Like, I've successfully amused her.
Oh, yeah, backstage.
If I get a snort.
It's got to be hard, though, with a play like this, with, you know, the theme and hearing snorts from backstage. It's got to be something that can throw people.
Amplified snorts, yes.
We have to make a lot of jokes. I mean, the play is really a very heavy play, and so we try to make as many jokes as possible backstage.
It weighs 100 pounds. It's very heavy.
We want to hear all about that.
We will.
But first, Paul, I want to ask you, How was everything really on that trip?
Oh, it was good. I want to throw a special thank out there to Mark Aidan Gray. And I have if he was here, I would toast him. You know, if he was here, but since he's not here, I've decided rather than toasting him, I'm going to share a traditional Aussie beverage recipe. Since he is Australian,
yes, of course.
And I thought that I would do that in sort of homage to him. So I found this traditional Australian brew online. And just to make sure it's culturally accurate, I pulled this off the authority for Australian brews. This is from the Outback Steakhouse website.
Wow.
This is called the Sugar Plum Martini, okay, which I'm sure is just, you know, majestic people. I'm sure they make this quite commonly. Grey Goose Vodka, Saint Germain Elderflower Liqueur, Amaretto di Serono, Apothic Red Blend. I don't know what it is, but there's a registered trademark next to Apothic. And pomegranate mixed and decorated with a sugar-dusted rim and a candy gumdrop ornament. Yes.
Wow. No stravia to that.
Yeah, exactly.
No stravia.
And of course, in keeping with Australian tradition, if you actually drink this, you are beaten and imprisoned by the British.
I was going to say, it sounds a little fancy for Australia, doesn't it?
Oh, it's a tad foppish, don't you?
Yeah.
I went to the Outback Steakhouse website, and it's like, Aussie Cobb salad. And it's like a Cobb salad.
Right.
And it's like, you know, the Down Under steak. And it's steak.
I mean, the drink is pretty manly until you get to the sugar-coated rim and then the gumdrop.
Well, the great thing is,
if you're a dude, don't put the gumdrop on there, right?
Make sure that you use Grey Goose vodka in something like this, which might as well, you know, have, you know, an insulin dipping sauce with it. Like, you're not going to have any idea what quality vodka is in this.
Is it important that you listen to Tchaikovsky while drinking
yes,
that?
You do. Yes, you do. But no, it was great having him here. We had I listened to the shows. He did a wonderful job. But and we are grateful to Mark.
So. Yes, we are.
Yeah. And how was your week?
Good. But back to Mark for a moment. Yes. I had the pleasure of spending, as you know, Christmas Eve dinner
with him
with
and his lovely wife, Victoria.
And yes, yeah. And you know, they've got some big news, and which they announced that evening.
Yeah.
Yes, and they're with child.
Oh, and, congratulations.
Yeah, and they're also leaving this fine land of Los Angeles for Berlin.
Berlin, right, where she is from. Yeah.
She is from there, and it's the work factor is higher for her there. So,
wow.
Taken off here in April.
Which bums me out, because I've known them for a while, but we really only got close recently. He actually helped me with an audition the other day, because he's a wonderful acting coach,
yes,
too.
Yes, he is.
And, but, good thoughts. And
and the Christmas Eve dinner, which was very, very lovely, was all Viennese.
Wow.
How great is that?
Really?
Yeah.
So just sausages as far as you could see.
No, but the
those cakes. Those Christmas cakes, right? The Viennese that you cut.
They actually had a different kind of dessert than that, but it was very lush with fruit and cream and all this lovely stuff. And Wiener Schnitzel for the main course.
Oh, okay.
And some sort
That's pounded veal, right?
Very pounded veal.
Okay.
I mean,
very
it was
pounded
paper
veal.
Paper thin.
Okay.
And in a light breading, dusted.
In
it?
Iowa.
Like the cocktail now.
In Iowa, we call that tenderloin.
Tenderloin?
Yeah.
Really?
And, yeah. They're great.
And
I mean,
here
it's
we
just
call it country fried steak.
Yeah.
right. Better, yeah.
No, but it was far better than country fried steak.
And in Outback, it's Aussie country fried steak.
That's right.
But it's the same.
But it was a very nice way to, and a very different, unusual meal for Christmas. I liked it.
Yeah,
I liked
it a lot. He said he had a lovely time. They were telling me that
indeed.
As well.
So, I kicked off LA's Next Great Stage Star at the club this past Sunday. And LA's Next Great Stage Star, if you haven't heard of it, is we're 9 years into this, is a musical theater competition.
Ooh, wow.
That I created in 2007.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it is we got huge reviews.
Yeah, I saw.
Did you see it?
You also had, it wasn't that show, but it was shortly before that show, you had Liza Minnelli in the club.
Liza Minnelli.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh,
on stage.
Goodness.
And Allison Janney, if you know Allison.
Yeah. Wow,
So we had a great holiday time period there in December. Then we opened Stage Star on January 4th. It goes for 6 weeks. And what we do is we have contestants, people who audition for as contestants, and between the ages of 18 and 32. And most of them are fresh out of the universities and, if not out of university, from some other part of the country out here for 15 minutes.
Wow.
And this is the contest that is where they need to be, because all of the hierarchy of Broadway musical theater business here in SoCal is there.
And how
that
many?
Gives me goosebumps.
How
That's
many?
Amazing.
How many past contestants? I'm sorry.
No.
How many past contestants have been on Broadway now?
11.
11.
11 since we started. They've all made their Broadway debuts, and some are on their third and fourth Broadway shows.
So it's kind of like American Idol, except for
exactly
for theater,
exactly
for musical theater, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm judging,
but
panels,
it's but far more encouraging and far more nurturing. Like, I was actually going to do the competition, but I had a conflict.
Why didn't you?
I can't sing or dance. Oh, look at the time. Okay.
Oh, hey.
Sorry. No, that sounds wonderful.
Well, I wasn't going to say not to mention the age,
not
but then I won't
the
go
age.
There.
Thank you. Thank you, Captain Obvious. Appreciate it.
But enough about that.
All right.
Well, you were missed, Paul. We're glad to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
Mark,
I'm glad to be back with these folks.
Absolutely.
So would you do me a favor and give the lovely woman to your left the intro she is so aptly due?
I will. Indeed. In addition, ladies and gentlemen, to her extensive film work, including The M Word and the upcoming Ovation with James Denton.
Great friend of the show.
Yes, our first guest is a mainstay of the Los Angeles theater community, starring in successful productions of A.R. Gurney's Sylvia, Nash's The Rainmaker, which was a Los Angeles Times critic's pick, and Claire Chaffee's, Chaffee, am I saying that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Why We Have a Body, which also marked her directing debut. Please welcome Tana Frederick.
We get crazy here now.
Yeah. Hey. Now, I like that intro. I liked the, I was playing the air guitar. That's awesome.
Before we get to the show, well, we'll talk about the show first because we'll have time to talk about this at the end of the show. The premise of this show and the fact that it originates in a true story of Henry Jaglom's father. I want to jump right into it because I'm curious about the script, when you were working on it, because I know, I mean, I don't know Mr. Jaglom. I've seen his a good number of his films. There's a real sort of naturalistic tendency with him, a lot of improvised dialogue and things like that. Was this script sort of in stone? Did you guys workshop it? Did you play with different things? Like, what was that creative process like for you?
Henry's plays, you are so screwed if you change a word in it.
Oh, okay.
It's okay. Pretty amazing, actually. His plays, I mean, they're word for word. He watches them. He corrects you. He gives you. I mean, not so much with this one because there's so much exposition with this play and there's so much history with his play, right. Which is necessary to really get into the love story and of these this. Couple, but yeah. But yes, it's not. There's no improvisation. I mean, opening weekend, I think we were improvising a little bit because we're talking about Warsaw, 1928. Well, I mean, right, Mike? It's you haven't introduced Mike yet, but yeah.
I'm the voice. I'm the voice in your head.
Mike is a disembodied voice that's just here in the room. Mike, chime in. We will introduce you shortly, but people will find out.
Thank you. No, she's right. The we did, you know, we've been working on it for months before it actually went up, but to get to that point, there was a lot of like, well, why would they say this? And that doesn't make sense. And then it repeats here. And so that sort of counteracts that. And so there was a lot of that
coming into it.
Yeah.
But as there will be with any world premiere when you just sort of.
Sure.
You know, yeah.
But for the most part, once we got it up, that was it. And that was, and then it was just a question of actually wrapping your heads around all of those words because it's a lot of dialogue.
Oh, is it?
It's a lot of dialogue.
Yeah. It's almost like seeing Les Mis without the music. You know, and right. I mean literally, and then
just
you have
dance
to
and yeah,
without the dancing too. Yeah, I can't sing or dance either. But it's a really beautiful story, and I was so proud of Henry because he's written so much. You know, his tendency is to write about show business folk or cover women's issues, and he's never ever covered anything historically with his family. And this is a true story of his father who got into a train compartment in 1928, was invited into a train compartment with a lieutenant and a nurse and and a couple other people, and he got on, and they started making incredible. Warsaw at that time was very anti-Semitic, and so they started making incredibly anti-Semitic remarks. And he decided he was just going to, you know, for the comfort of the cabin because he didn't have a seat, just go along with it and pretend to be Jewish. And then the nurse said, "I can smell a Jew a kilometer away," and he decided, "I'm going to quote unquote kiss the girl, and then tell her I'm Jewish." So they got off at this resort called Zakopane, and a love story ensued, and they both fell in love. And I'm not going to tell any more because you have to come to see the play rest of that.
Right. and Zakopane is southern Poland. I believe it's just south of Warsaw. I don't know. But
yes,
it's been a resort community for a long
time.
Just read the cards, hon. Read them.
We know that it's in the mountains.
It's in the mountains.
It's a ski resort.
Okay. I know it's a little bit cheesier now. It's more of a touristy spot, but then it was very luxurious and very upper class, and the socioeconomic sort of play between my character being a nurse and having made her way up, you know, to the middle class, and then him being very rich, and which what Henry's father, well, I mean, Henry's father was, you know, had a nice amount of cash. Yeah. And and so, you know, he swept her off her feet. And but he ended up, well, he ended up, they ended up falling in love. And
yeah, what started out is his intention to take revenge on her. And then during the sort of seduction, he actually falls in love with her.
Wow.
And so now he's screwed.
And she is too.
No. That is the, in terms of, there was something that occurred to me while you were saying that. I'm trying to bring it back here. This experience that his father had, is there like an attempt to make this character, the female character, like accurate to that woman that he described, or is she historically accurate as she can be, or did he just sort of take that character, that persona, and sort of build a fictional character?
That's a really interesting question, because I think the play to me communicates hope. I mean, I would hope it communicates hope because of the love that is found within it and the sort of forgiveness of it. But Henry's father told him this story in very hushed tones, never said it around his mother. And he said, this is the one thing I've always been ashamed of. And his story was that, so at the end, he told, when they were leaving each other, he said, you know, I'm Jewish. And they had this romantic, crazy weekend. And she burst into tears, ran off crying. And then she ran back and gave him this ring in the shape of a triangle, which I'm wearing right now because we're doing the show tonight. But kissed him passionately and ran off. And he never saw her again. The ring was ruined destroyed in the Blitz. And his father said, this is a story. This is the only thing I'm ashamed of in my life, is that I did this to her. So she's quite a mystery. And Henry, I really wanted Henry to explore and help explore the backstory of what is behind hatred. Why was she this hateful? Why, you know, and so, so developing that and really making her ignorance, not something, evil,
right,
you know,
right.
was really tough, because the whole second act is a love story between them. So if I don't, like, it's very difficult to play the part, because if I don't play it somewhat charmingly, then nobody's going to want to hang out for the second act
A
love story.
Right.
And luckily Mike is a brilliant actor and makes me look really good.
Well, and you also have to have something redeeming in you to be, I mean, no man on a train, I mean, you're obviously a very attractive woman, but no man on a train is going to fall in love or follow someone who is pure evil. You have to have some sort of, you know, redeeming quality to you, not only from the point of view of an audience embracing you, but for the sake of the story as well.
Exactly. You know? And it was really interesting playing with all of the, because there's so many, I say so many awful things, and at first I was very, it was very emotional, and I still get very emotional during the performances. But Gary Emhoff really helped me to figure out exactly how to say.
That's the director.
You know, the director, yeah, Gary Emhoff, did such a beautiful, beautiful job, and so I like, at first I was saying, "Oh, was he Jewish? A Jew? Oh, he was a Jew," and it was like a Jew. Like, he's like, Gary was like, okay, Tana, you can't, no more choose. Because I was
just throwing
it off. I was like, I can't say it. I can't do this. Because I think, being raised in Iowa, I'm actually, like, prejudice against prejudice. So I really, this play is tough.
You don't have prejudice in Iowa?
We're prejudiced against prejudice. I mean, honestly, like,
really?
It's like you have an open mind and you
really?
Don't judge. Yes, absolutely.
Huh. Well, that sounds
absolutely.
Good.
I mean... yeah, that's what I was raised doing. So this was a really, really hard part for me to play. And I've had to take a lot of Nazine during it, because I actually get, like, train sick. Like,
oh,
literally,
really?
Saying the lines.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the last weekend, I didn't tell Mike, but I ran off stage.
I got a message afterwards. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Like, I didn't tell Mike, but there's a scene where I say why I'm so hateful of the Jews, which has to do with my father being having an experience experience with an Orthodox Jew and taking his business away. And I say, literally the lines are, I have to go back to the room. I'm going to be sick. And, you know, it's the whole moment where you have my moment of redemption in the play. Mm. And I literally ran off stage and projectile vomited because it just, I can't say it without...
Oh, but wait, it gets better.
Okay, all right.
There's a scene where we kiss directly afterwards.
She's a lady.
Yeah.
Well, as unpleasant as that was, I have to say I'm so happy that that happened when we weren't sharing a dressing room.
Right.
Because, Michael, yes. We were talking about this before the show, that we were both doing shows at the Edgemar and sharing dressing rooms at the same time.
You were sharing a dressing room, or you were just trying to get into her dressing room?
The backstage at the Edgemar is basically a communal dressing room with some curtains. It's a great space. The Edgemar is great. I love the people who work there and that. But it's just, you know, if you got two shows going on, it's like any Equity Waiver Theater in town. It's a little intimate.
And it's but it's really fun because it's like the energy of you doing a flea in her ear.
Yeah. With a cast of 22.
With a cast of 22. Yeah. Well, we were doing Sylvia? No.
That was Sylvia.
That was Sylvia.
It was Ghosts we were doing when you were doing Why We Have a Body.
But we were all cheering each other on, and it was kind of this communal, they were stoked about their show, and then I'm how did the scene go? And we all got along really, really well. The energy fed into each other's performances.
And speaking of fed, she fed us on more than one occasion because they had a far larger catering budget than we did. They had pizza and salads, and we had one sleeve of Malamars for 22 people.
That's just not okay.
Feed those people.
Henry always gets on me for that, but it's the one thing that you can do for actors is
feed them.
Yes. Well, there's love of Mike. I mean,
there's that great line in Producers. That great line in the original Producers, the Zero Mostel Producers, where he says, "I know what we'll do. We'll kill the actors. you can't kill the actors. They're human beings." Oh yeah, did you ever eat with one? just love. I wanted to ask you something that occurred to me while you were talking about that and what preceded the nausea and all that. You talk about that emotional place that you have to go to as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of emotional place was it, if you could, not to speak for him, but I'm trying to imagine what that must be like for Henry, for the writer, to visit all of these things. Did it affect him as deeply and emotionally as it affected you, or is it something he's just had more time to process? Or?
It's kind of it's sunken into me. And at first, he was just the very first performance we did. He was perfect. That would have been a take. That would have been on film. We would have been done. You know, that's exactly how I want it filmed, because he does want to turn it into a film. But now it's really sinking into me. And the last three times he came, he cried, which was good because, you know, it's more about his father and rooting for his father. I mean, our audiences are fun. It's our audiences are like a black audience, except they're Jewish.
Wow. So
which
an
85-year-old, they're like, oi. They're like, and it's very interactive, and I love shows like that where it's so interactive. But
just because of the proximity of the people?
Because it's a smaller, it's a 99-seat theater, but people...
You're in the theater to the left as you walk in the Edgemar? The one
going
in the lobby? Okay,
yes.
All right,
But Henry's quit coming to the shows because it's too emotionally... he's just you have to do it. You have to go through it. I get kind of mad at him for that, because I'm okay, I'm in agony every night. And then he walks out. He's always there for every curtain call, and he walks out, and everybody congratulates him on this show because it's a really brilliant show, and I think it's the best thing he's ever written. And so he walks through the lobby, I guess, and gets kudos. And then I'm backstage lying on the floor I'm going to puke. And he's like, "What's wrong with you? There's tons of people out there who love the show. Oh, my God. What did you do tonight?" And I'm like, I'm going to get you. That is not fair.
Can I recover a little?
Yeah.
Can I just recover a little?
Wow. We have to go see this show.
Yeah, no, I do want to see it. I want to see it very, very soon. Oh, and we should, Michael, would you let people know?
I will.
How they can do just that?
I will indeed. Train to Zakopane, A True Story of Hate and Love, as we're talking about, which is produced by Alexandra Guarnieri.
Yes.
Yes. Oh,
very good.
Yeah. Thank
you.
Yeah.
Right. I'm Ron Burgundy.
And directed by Gary Imhoff, who previously directed Mr. Jaglom's Always But Not Forever, just 45 minutes from Broadway, and A.R. Gurney's Sylvia at the Etmar Center for the Arts. Tickets cost $34.99 for general admission. And it, as I said, a true story, and it plays Thursday through Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 5 p.m. The Edgemar Center for the Arts is located at 2437 Main Street in Santa Monica, California. Lovely area over there. Parking is available in an adjacent lot, actually, and there is a slight fee charge for that. And nearby, metered parking. So it's pretty easy to do all this. Reservations, 310-392-7327, or go online to Edgemar Center, CENTER.org.
EdgemarCenter.org. Yes. And also directly, and this is a great area of that section, about a great thing about that area of Santa Monica, is get there early, park once, do dinner. You can walk down the street. You got 40 food
restaurants.
Wolfgang Puck's original place is just down the street there. And there's a phenomenal deli directly across the street. Not directly across the street, because
that
Captain's Galley.
Such a good
but you go up about half a block and there's a deli there. And I have been on a search for good liverwurst in Los Angeles, and I finally found it there.
Really?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It is truly a European deli.
Yeah.
If I can tell another story.
Sure, sure.
About Mike Falco, my brilliant co-star. Henry cast him. This is really interesting because Henry's really, really particular at casting. I think that's one of his... I mean, every film I've seen, that's one of the things that I'm shocked by, because he really does have... I mean, he's worked with Melissa Leo and David Duchovny and Jamie Denton and all these people who are brilliant. And usually he needs to have a meeting with them before and let them read and, you know, but he, it was really funny because we sat down with Mike and Gary Imhoff, and Henry looked at Mike and had brief conversation with him and cast him on the spot without hearing him read, without anything. He just saw his father and Mike, which was, which is pretty incredible. And Mike is absolutely brilliant in the role. And,
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you. It was a very surprising thing for me. Actually, the way that I told you this, I think, but I'd kind of taken a break from acting, and I'd been concentrating on some writing projects that I'm working on and some directing things that I'm doing. And so I got an email from Gary, who I hadn't heard from in years, and he said, "Well, can you take a look at the script?" And so me, thinking that I'm reading it from a writer's standpoint, I read the script, and I go, "Wow, beautiful script! It's, you know, it's awesome." And so I send him an email back, and he goes, "Well, would you mind meeting with us?" I'm like, "Sure," you know. So I showed up, and I mean, you remember, I had freaking black
nail polish on
my nails, and I wasn't there for an audition at all. Like, I showed up to have lunch with these nice people, and so, and the reason I had black nail polish on was because I have a kid, I have a 6-year-old kid, and we were walking through Montrose one day, and we saw a nail polish salon. He's like, "Let's go get our nails done." I'm like, "All right, why not?" So that, and that was the day before. So I showed up with nail polish on, and anyway, so I sit down, and we have lunch, and it's great, and I'm, you know, then it starts to sort of click in my head of like,
I'm at an audition.
I think I might, okay. But then, he offered me the part right across the table, and I was like, okay,
Sure? What had you done with Gary before that?
I had met Gary years ago in an acting class. He had subbed in for the teacher that I was studying with at the time. And so that's how I met him.
Okay.
And, you know, then I came to see Always But Not Forever, and that's how Tana and I met in, like, 2007.
And he also, Mike was a professional surfer and moved out here and slept on my co-star of Always But Not Forever's couch and decided
to
be an
actor.
I'm
so glad you finished that because you had just said that he slept on your co-star. And yeah, I was like, oh, the couch.
Well, that's
a different story. Very different
story. We won't go there today, but well, that'll be next time.
No, David O'Donnell is he's one of my oldest friends in L.A. since I first came here and we became surfing buddies.
Oh, okay.
And he was in the show with Tanner. And so I came to see him and support, and you know, I was like, "Wow, this is great!" And oh, Gary directed this, and hi, Tana.
It all comes together. Yeah. You work with good people, and then the paths cross. And yeah,
yeah. And it was just—it's just amazing, though. I mean, Henry casting his own father. I had no idea who we would pick, but he just met Mike, and just Mike's essence. He just knew, and then he stayed, and then he's done enough plays with
Gary.
Could
have been the black nail polish too.
No, it could, it probably was black nail. No. But he's worked. But you know, he's worked with Gary a lot, so he stayed away for every single rehearsal. Never saw Mike through our 6-month rehearsal process. Never saw him act. He's like, so can he act? Can he act? I'm like,
6-month rehearsal.
Yeah,
process.
He got it.
Just sporadic.
It wasn't 6 months.
Well, it was.
No, it was.
Whatever.
No. 3 months.
It was 6 months.
Okay.
We worked so hard.
It was 6 years. It was Andre Gregory's Alice in
Before
Wonderland.
Before we get back to Mike, yeah. Tana wanted to talk about something that she's getting ready to do quickly.
Yes.
On the 17th, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
It's Amir Baraka's The Dutchman, and we did a reading at the Shakespeare Center. And it's actually going to be on Martin Luther King Jr.'s...
The Dutchman, the two people on the train?
Yes, yes. And it's been my favorite play for so long. One of my... And so Levy Lee Simon, who wrote The Grand... Oh, God. He's going to kill me for not remembering. But he has a play running simultaneously, but he directed... We've done a stage reading, and this reading went amazingly well. And I've always wanted to mount this play. And so I'm going to... funny enough, while I was doing the show, I got a call while I was doing Zakopane to do... Lee asked me to do this because we graduated from University of Iowa together. We worked together. I was in other plays of his. And it's another... I play another bigot on a train, in 1964. Mm-hmm. And so I'm doing a back-to-back performance of these two two plays, and I think I'll probably die at the end. my friend Noah Wiley wrote me after I sent him the press release this morning. He goes, are you kidding me? You're doing these two plays together? He's like, just remember, they shoe horses, don't they?
Yeah, right, exactly.
He's like, good luck. Bravo.
Yeah.
So, but it is, you know, with everything that's going on right now, I feel like, especially everything that's happening in France and all over the world, this play is so important. It's important for people to not hate and to understand where other people come from. And I think that creates healing and that creates understanding. And so, I've been really happy with the responses. I thought playing this part, I told Henry, I'm never going to get hired in this town again playing an anti-Semite. But it's been, people have walked out and they've been crying. It's like you root for this couple, you root for them to get past their prejudices, you know, and it's a beautiful, beautiful play.
Well, and the thing is, everyone knows there are people. We all know. People that are that, but it does not define them as people. Some it does define when people are so myopic and so narrow-minded they have to stack their thoughts. There are some people that are just defined by their hate, but there, when a character or a person is as layered as what you're describing, that's probably why. I mean, that is why audiences are embracing it as well.
Yeah, I believe like hate. True hatred comes from a love and being hurt by love, and then. The hate comes from that. It's a byproduct of loving something so much, and I truly believe that everybody has a story, you know, who commits atrocities, and so this kind of brings to light really well through a love story.
And a personal take on a global issue.
Exactly.
A face-to-face take. Oh, that's fascinating. We're going to introduce, I'm going to introduce Michael. I'm going to continue talking what we're talking about, but I'm going to give Michael his due as well. Our next guest describes himself as an aspiring human. Born and raised in South Africa, a successful professional surfing career segued to another creative outlet in acting. On television, he has been seen on Law & Order, L.A., Fastlane, and The Stafford Project. His film credits include Smoking Aces, the upcoming Something About Her, and Deceived, which he also wrote and produced. Please welcome Mike Falco. That's all I got.
Right.
Michael is so angry with me of only having these sound bites for now 200 shows.
Exactly. What happened? You said.
It's my first day back.
Tana gets the Who, and I get the Backwoods guy.
So
you got Iowa hee-haw. Come on.
What was the segue from surfing to acting? I mean, what was?
We kind of talked about it a little bit. Was my older friend David O'Donnell, who's a phenomenal actor himself, and he and I were surfing buddies, and so I was staying on his couch and just kind of finding my feet in L.A. And I was still competing at the time, and then we would go surfing, and he was dating a girl who he's now married to, Jennifer Aspen, who was on Party of Five, and it just seemed like a fun world to me. It seemed this whole acting thing, and they were both very successful at it. And I was like, well, that seems fun. How do you do that?
So nothing before that, in South Africa, no less
I mean,
school
I'd
plays
done,
or anything
I'd done
like
a high school thing here and there, but it really just wasn't my thing. You know, I was a surfer. I'd sort of systematically dropped away anything that got in the way of surfing.
Oh, okay.
You know, I'm in awe of where you come from. I've been there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I had an amazing experience there.
It is a very beautiful, very raw place.
And down to Cape Town. And
who were you? What were you there with?
Andy Gibb.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
And we were not playing Cape Town. We were playing in another part of South Africa. Yeah, big casino. Sun City.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Right, I worked as a lifeguard there, you know.
Did you really?
At the Lost City, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I spent the summer working as a lifeguard.
Such an interesting experience. You know, we were on the tail end of it being okay to play that part of the country.
Right.
And right after us, it was not okay.
Oh, that was the whole Stevie Van Zandt don't want to go to Sun City thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was odd because, you know, we as Americans coming into that territory, they're the staff of the hotel, and nobody looked at you. You know, they didn't make eye contact with you. They looked down and served you, and the housekeepers would look down. They would never acknowledge your presence. They were only there to do what they had to do, you know.
What year was this, Michael?
You know, I honestly cannot remember. I know it was in the 80s, in the mid-80s. And
That's a sign of respect, by the way, in the tribes.
Is it?
Is it?
But it made us feel very uncomfortable.
I understand, there's obviously a cultural divide, but for what it's worth, right. They were showing you respect.
The oddest thing that happened, I might say, is that when we were leaving, you know, you have to go through Johannesburg. When we were leaving, we stopped in Johannesburg to refuel, and Andy was very agitated on the flight and tired and cranky, and he wanted to get off the plane at that point just to stretch his legs. I said no, because they had made an announcement that we could not get off the plane. The plane was going to be cleaned during this interlude, and we were to remain in our seats. It was very clear instructions, and he didn't like hearing them because he's not used to being told that he can't do something. So he said, "Oh, I'm going, mate. I'm going." And you know, and I had to go right behind him and say, "Dude, don't do that. You know, here we go." And well, what we didn't know is the plane was completely surrounded by the military with rifles at the plane because we were coming from South Africa, that part of South Africa.
Really? Oh, thank God that has changed.
And he appeared at the doorway, and they all went up and cocked their rifles, and I just pulled him by the neck back into the plane and put him back in the...
You know, the things that fall under your job description.
I know, right? Right.
Saving someone from a horrible death by machine gun.
Yeah. So bizarre.
So born and raised there.
Yes.
And you have a lovely accent.
Lovely.
Thank you. I worked on it for many years.
And, and in this production, do you adapt another accent? Are accents used in this? Or
well, that was a whole conversation in the beginning of rehearsal of how would we approach this? Because, you know, I'm fairly adept with accents and I can do different things. So I was speaking to Gary. I was like, well, what would you like? And the idea of avoiding the complication of having everyone speak with a Polish accent, because ultimately we're speaking English. It should be subtitled, really. I mean, we should be speaking Polish.
Yeah, right.
And it talks about that in the script of how we. Someone mentions to me, "You speak good Polish." So the assumption is that we're speaking Polish,
right. But
that I have a slight accent because I'm Russian. And so I was like, well, I can do a Russian accent. And then the idea was like, well, why don't we have everyone just speak in their normal accents and then have me speak in mine? And ultimately, I've sort of adapted it into a little bit more of a sort of upper class, almost British type thing. Mm-hmm. Just to sort of, because he's kind of an elegant guy and he's from a you know, privileged background and that kind of thing. And it just kind of seems to work. And actually, part of the discussion in the beginning was, you know, what was that movie with Valkyrie? Do you remember in Valkyrie? Mm. When in the very beginning, he starts speaking in German as he's sort of narrating his letter. And then there's the sort of crossfade into his regular accent, and then the words turn into English. And it you just kind of go with it, you suspend the disbelief. And we figured that would be... That would be a workable analogy.
Judgment in Nuremberg, they do the same thing. They have the Maximilian Schell has the headset on and he's speaking in German, and then it just sort of goes into English.
But with the
headset and everything.
And from an audience standpoint, you just kind of go with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Steve Howard plays a very judgmental and suspicious priest, also an anti-Semite, and he does a brilliant job at it. But he's constantly questioning Mike's character, saying, "You sound like, so are you Northern Russia or?" I mean, he just is constantly, like, questioning him. And actually, Henry loved the idea that Mike would have a South African accent. And the rest of us just... I wanted to do a Polish accent, but the rest of us are just speaking, you know... And the language that Henry writes is so... what do I want to say? It's so lyrical, and it makes it very 1928-ish because it is sort of stunted, and he wrote it brilliantly for that time.
The writing is beautiful, and the language is very almost grandiose, but and it
like
works
stylized?
For that time.
It's
very sort of period, and it rolls off the tongue in a very sort of intelligent way.
Okay.
But it works really well because, in fact, if he were to have done a Russian accent and the rest of us would have done a Polish accent, that's a different story. But if he would have done a Russian accent and the rest of us are speaking in English, then you're like, wait, it doesn't quite complete the whole thing. But for some reason, the South African accent plays beautifully into this because the whole audience is like, well, where is he from? What is he... They follow it, you know. It works beautifully.
Well, and not only that, but also just the basic theatrical logistics of it. If it is as textually heavy as you say, and it's fairly dense, to get all of that information out and exposition out and have it with a sense of clarity for the audience, for the Edgemar audience, you know, you'd want to just make your job as easy as possible there.
Yeah.
I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Now, I know this play runs through March, at the end of March, but like everything you do there, it seems to get extended and extended, and you end up...
Yeah, we're very
these
fortunate.
These year runs.
Yeah, I know.
Does this have that you have a sense of this at this point?
I'm hoping we make the film before a year comes by.
Oh, yeah?
You sell out. No.
Come on, let's go to Europe. Let's make a movie.
But I don't know. We've had tons of packed houses. We have... Like I said, like 85-year-old couples leaving, and the gentlemen are comforting their wives as they're crying, and it has staying power. I think, and I'm surprised we have completely packed houses.
Well, it's interesting, just from an audience standpoint, we've had very young, hip audiences come and love it, and then I mean, there was that one night where this old Polish woman in a wheelchair gets rolled up to me after the show, and like with tears streaming down her face, she reaches out to me with this shaky hand and is like, thank you, this was like my life, I lived this. And it just killed me. Like, I melted inside. I was like,
And you know, it sounds too, like you say, younger audiences appreciating, older audiences appreciate it, because it's a story that can be embraced on so many levels. If it's a love story, and you have people who might not, very, very young people who may not know, have as detailed, you know, a mental history of all that took place there, but you know, they can learn about it through the experience of these two people.
Yes, this younger girl came with her husband, and she said she was determined to get every single the younger crowd in, because it's such an important time to learn about, to remember, to you know, not forget, so that mistakes aren't repeated. And so we have this great mix of audience members, young and old, and because everybody during that time has a story. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a particular story from that time, who lived during that time. And if they didn't, if they're younger and they didn't live during that time, their grandparents told them a story, or their great grandparents told them a story, or something was passed down. Yeah. And so it's like, the more, because this play is so specific, I think it really appeals, if this makes sense, generally to people, like to the general audience, because. Wow. Because everybody has something emotional that sits inside them from that time.
Right. It sounds amazing.
No, it does.
And we should be there. And you, ladies and gentlemen, listening to this program today, should be there. And it is Train to Zakopane, A True Story of Hate and Love, which runs Thursday through Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 5 p.m. at the lovely Edgemoor Center for the Arts in Santa Monica. The pricing on the show is very affordable at $34.99. A ticket, parking is available in the adjacent lot of the theater. Good to know where parking is in these cases. And at a nearby metered municipal parking lot. Reservations 310-392-7327 or online at edgemoorcenter.org. Go out and see and support theater. Get away from your televisions.
Get away from the Netflix.
Yep, away from the Netflix and go and be real.
Tana, can you give something to our listeners in terms of where they can look for information on The Dutchman, the name of the company, website or something? Even if you don't have that, I know I'm putting you on the spot with this, but if you just, the name of the company or the location that people could do a search for it.
Sure. Dutchman. I think there'll be a website up soon.
Okay. All right.
But you can look it up. It's Leroy Jones, but then he changed his name to Amir Baraka. And you can find it online, but it'll be on the Edgemoor and the 17th. It'll talk about the 17th and doing this sort of double feature. And there'll be wine for people who want to come. There'll be wine.
Oh, is that the same location?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I'm doing it on the same stage.
Oh, wow.
So I'm playing a bigot on two trains.
Okay.
And there'll be wine and cheese with it. So it'll make it better.
That was a Billy Crystal movie, wasn't it? Bigot on two trains? Throw the bigot from the train.
Throw the bigot off the train.
Right. Throw the bigot off the train.
So check on the Edgemoor Center for the Arts.
Okay.
And
so it's the same. So edgemoorcenter.org.
Right.
Yeah.
So now we have to baptize.
It's that time.
Oh,
right.
And I'm sorry. One more thing.
Yes.
All the proceeds from that are going to the Museum of Tolerance. So the minimum donation for that is 25. But I'm really hoping that people come out and support. You know, with, like I said, with all the political current scene and everything going on, I think doing both of these shows is going to be pretty amazing. But our show is amazing within itself.
It sounds it. I definitely am going to catch this one.
Yes,
we have only about 3.5 minutes left. This just flew.
Yes,
but at the end of the show, I normally tell people before this. I didn't get a chance to tell you guys up front, but we like to ask people about an onstage mishap, something that went wrong during performance, something embarrassing, not necessarily this show. And Mr. James Denton told me that I have to ask about a particular stage kiss. Can you share that with us, Tana, in your allotted minute and a half?
half. Turned crimson
he's so,
red.
Yes. He's so dumb, James. I'm going to get him back. Yeah. No, I did, when I was doing the Rainmaker with Robert Stanley, he coin pursed me, which it's a way of he kissed me. He squeezed my mouth together like a coin purse, and then shoved his tongue in my mouth. Oh. And that happened during every show. And so I was like, Jamie, don't coin purse me, okay? And he just thought that was really. I mean, every single night Robert would squeeze my mouth together and then shove his tongue down my throat.
I've never heard that term, coin purse.
I came up with that. I was just like, that's the only thing I can describe.
Oh,
as this part.
It's the chubby bunny face. It's chubby bunny.
Yeah. Like your face is a coin purse, and then the tongue goes. His tongue goes in. But women loved it. I mean, women loved that. I was
women loved it who were not on the recipient.
Who weren't the being coin purse.
Oh,
man.
Mike kisses beautifully and has never coin purse me.
Mike kisses like a leather clutch as opposed to a cord purse. Mike, do you have a tale for us in a minute and a half?
Gosh, there's been a couple, but probably the most memorable is when Steve hit me with a book.
The priest.
Well, he goes and he pulls this thing off of like the place where you keep your baggage, and it's right above my head. And for some reason, this book it was a very problematic book. It kept sliding off of the thing, and one night it cracks me like square on the nose.
Oh.
As I'm looking up, and now I'm trying to think of like how am I going to work this in. I cannot ignore the fact that this just happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
everyone
about,
saw it. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And then about two lines later, Tanner said something to me that was kind of feisty, and it's in the dialogue. But and so my response was, "Well, the priest just hit me with a book. Are you going to do the same?"
Beautiful.
Nice
good recovery.
Work.
Yeah.
Good work.
Oh well, what a pleasure to have you.
Truly,
with us.
Really enjoyed.
Oh, thank
yeah,
you
both of you.
So much for your support of LA theater. There is so many. I just want to say you guys know this. There's so many, and you do it, both of you. There's so much brilliant theater in this town, and it is so underrated. And this show, I'm very proud of, and I thank you for getting it out there. Thank you so much.
Not at all. And my
absolutely.
Pleasure having you, both of you.
Thanks
on.
Thanks for having me.
Quick, very, very quick, once again, tickets, 310-392-7237. That's 310-392-7237. And online at edgemarcenter.org. So the play is Train to Zakopane, a true story. Did I say plane?
Train.
A play. The play is a train.
The play is a train.
Train to Zakopane, a true story of hate and love, running Thursdays through Saturdays at 7:30 and Sundays at 5. What a pleasure. Thank you both.
Indeed. And welcome back, Paul.
It's so good to be back. And we will see you next week.
And Happy New Year, everybody.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohle right here on LA Talk Radio.